Thanks for choosing this GLT podcast. While it's free to you, it's not free to produce. Take a moment and make a contribution to pay for this program. Go to WGLT.org and thanks. Quick, before this podcast starts, take 90 seconds and help pay for it. Public media is funded by the public. Contribute at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's an update on the Town of Normal's Trail East project with Normal City Manager Pam Reese. She says buildings on East Beaufort would require substantial investment if they're not torn down. One of those buildings includes the popular mural.
What can we do to present a sense of interest and a sense of energy? If the mural is replaced with public art, maybe that's an option.
GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Normal City Manager Pam Reese. You'll hear from an Ameren, Illinois worker helping to restore infrastructure in Puerto Rico. Ameren's Eric Escra tells GLT's John Norton about the hurricane devastation he encountered, and he talks about the restoration efforts. And Bloomington State Senator Jason Barrickman has an update on the spring legislative season. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's May 1st, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Shortly after Normal City Manager Pam Reese took over from the retiring Mark Peterson, another person in a key position announced his retirement from the town. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Reese about City Engineer Gene Brown and the hole that creates in the town operation.
Actually, Gene's announcement was my first day on the job.
Congratulations.
He came into my house. Exactly. But certainly appreciated his conversation that I had with him. And he had given me a heads up a couple months back to let me know that he was considering retirement. So I knew it was going to be on the horizon. In terms of Gene's position, he's got an amazing institutional knowledge of the organization, because as city engineer, he's been involved in nearly every capital project that we've undertaken. Every street project, every road improvement project, I should say, trail extension, utility improvements, utility meaning water and sewer improvements, stormwater, detention basins, nearly everything that many people don't often think about, but is out there, projects where we invest our capital dollars. Gene has either been personally involved through a bidding process or a plan preparation process, or just an advisor as we go through those processes.
So what's the timeline for filling the position?
We have the city engineer position posted right now. We are seeking applications through about the later end of May. I think it's the third week of May we're seeking applications. And then we'll take some time to vet those applications, see if anybody rises to the top, and bring individuals in for an interview. I would assume that it will probably have someone on board mid to late summer.
Of course, you're going to lose that institutional memory, but it's an opportunity to reconsider the position. What will be important in that job going forward?
Similar skill sets, of course, in terms of working with contractors, working with outside developers and engineering consultants will be incredibly important in building those relationships. And then, of course, working with staff, working with me and the administrative team and the city council to evaluate our capital improvement needs for the future, assessing streets, and leading staff to be able to do that.
Is there anybody from within?
We have some senior project engineers. I haven't yet had an opportunity to speak with them to find out if either are interested. They both have similar tenure on the job, and they're both very skilled civil engineers. I think they enjoy what they're doing right now rather than taking a more administrative role, but we'll see. They could be applicants.
There is still no restaurant in One Uptown. Any prospects of one?
Well, it's been about a month or so since I've spoken with the developer, Doug Reichel. At that time, he was still making contact with restaurateurs to gauge interest in moving into that space. I haven't heard anything recently from him on any success in signing anyone. As I understand it, some of the challenges are associated with the build-out of the space. It's beautiful space. It's an envelope right now, so to speak, and it would need to be finished. And to finish that space out with an appropriate kitchen and such would be probably $1.5 to $2 million. And from a restaurateur's perspective, I'm told that that sort of initial capital investment is very difficult. But I think Doug Reichel and his team are continuing to seek out restaurateurs.
At what point does it... the lack of a restaurant become a violation of the development agreement?
That's a good question. I don't have the details of that agreement into memory, but I would have to check and explore that.
Is the town getting impatient about that, or is there still a while to go on that clock?
I believe there's some time to go on the clock, but I think more from a just an overall uptown energy perspective, we're very eager to get some action in that space.
Update us on the Trail East program, would you?
Sure. Staff is meeting with Bush Construction, which is the construction firm, the development company that council selected. And we're talking to Bush Construction biweekly now to talk them through the process of design concepts and such. And we anticipate having a design concept prepared to go to council in June to get city council reaction. Bush Construction is using the Farnsworth Group as their architect and engineering team. And so they're making progress in evaluating a footprint for the building and overall design scope.
Well, if you're that close to bringing it to council for a look-see, are those other buildings on the edge of that area going to be torn down? Are they trending that way or not?
Well, you're referring to the buildings along East Beaufort, and specifically 104, 106, and 108 East Beaufort have been the properties that have been under consideration. Right now, Bush is evaluating, along with the Farnsworth team, if those buildings can be saved, what would it take? And what would be the investment required to save those buildings? And if not, why not? And so they're preparing that story, and that's what we will discuss with council in June.
Which way are they trending?
I've seen a couple of design concepts that are footprints, but I think they're still working out the details, so I don't have any information to share at this point.
Regardless of whether the buildings are torn down, the mural would be covered up and or destroyed, depending. What's the latest on the mural and the efforts to either move it, preserve it, do something with it?
Well, that too is a good question, Charlie. We have been discussing the mural and why the mural is of such interest. If one looked at the mural today, they would see that the paint is chipping off and it would need some attention regardless of what happens with the building. And so in discussions with staff and some of the citizens about the future of the mural, we've talked more along the lines of what is attractive about the mural. And it's something that brings a sense of space, a sense of place, kind of a meeting spot for individuals. And if the mural is gone in the future, I think it'd be incumbent on us to find some sort of replacement type of experience for citizens. And so, you know, what can we do to present a sense of interest and a sense of energy for citizens to go to? And if the mural is replaced with public art, maybe that's an option. Something that brings the same sense of uniqueness and energy is what we need if the mural is gone.
I'm hearing there's not a lot of appetite from the town to preserve that.
I can only speak on behalf of staff at this point. The council has not had a public discussion, but I think when we've looked at the future of 104 East Beaufort, which is the building that contains the mural, we're a little bit concerned about what would be required if that specific building was intended to be redeveloped or reused. The building as it stands right now would require, we believe, a minimum of $300,000 investment just to bring it up to code. And so that would be a significant investment on a building. And then, of course, the future of the mural in terms of its current state, we would have to figure out how, you know, what to do with that anyway.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker with Pam Reese, the city manager for the town of Normal. The village of Deerfield recently passed an assault-style weapon ban. You're not even allowed to possess it, and there's a $1,000 a day fine for having such a firearm in the city limits of the village of Deerfield. What's your view on the advisability of that kind of ordinance?
I'm not familiar with Deerfield's ordinance, but based on the information, my first reaction would be a concern on how it would be enforced. How does one know? Is it based on a complaint basis that it's enforced or such? So I think there, from administratively, it would raise some concerns.
Are such municipal-level ordinances even good policy in a larger context where people just 6 inches on the other side of the border can have them?
That certainly, you know, I'm not sure, Charlie. I think that that would be a topic that would be a much broader discussion than just staff. I think that that would be a discussion with our sister city, with the county, with a leadership from all those entities to find out what we think would make sense for our community. And again, I think administratively, that sort of ordinance raises significant concerns from an enforcement standpoint.
The town's been noodling an effort to begin a multifamily residential recycling program. Where stands that?
We're in the stage right now where the issue came up as a result of our budget cuts, where we've eliminated the Dropbox recycling program. And four of those sites remain because the private sector vendor has decided to take those on. But in the meantime, we've been trying to figure out a solution to providing recycling services to those individuals that don't live in single-family properties. And so right now we're having conversations with stakeholder groups to gauge from them on what would make sense from a multifamily property tenant's perspective as well as a property manager's perspective, and then see if we can draft an ordinance that is reasonable and meets their needs while still providing a way for individuals, again, who don't live in single-family homes to have access to recycling. So those are interesting discussions. And from my perspective, I like to simplify things. And I think, well, how complicated can it be to provide recycling at a multifamily property? And it's been more complicated than I think, or than I expected, simply because of the commitments that multifamily property owners make and managers make to their tenants. Access to parking spaces and such. So it's been a very good conversation, and we believe we will be in a position to recommend to the city in July or August a multifamily recycling ordinance.
How expensive will that be?
Well,
for the town to implement?
For the town, it would be some administrative time in terms of staff oversight. The cost would be between the tenant and the property owner because the service would be provided by the private haulers.
What sort of vendors are there for that?
All the typical waste haulers that pick up trash and take it to the landfill also provide curbside options. So they would have dumpsters or garbage carts specifically for recycling, and then they bring those recycled materials to the same venue where we bring ours and for sorting and processing. So the private sector haulers are capable of doing that.
There are two schools of thought, the town of Normal being heavy on, of course, student tenancy, that students don't care. They're just going to dump their regular garbage in the area for recycling. Or students are younger. They're going to care about this more, and observance of separation is going to be not bad. What's the thinking on that in the focus group talks?
I think the belief is that like any neighborhood, everyone's different. And so we have a representative from the Student Government Association that's part of our committee in discussing this and is very eager to make sure the service is provided and supports the option for students to be able to have recycling at their off-campus housing. But we're also including conversations at the table with representatives from areas that aren't typically student housing. You know, we have a lot of multifamily properties that where tenants are families with young children or single parent families with maybe older children or young professionals. So there's a very broad spectrum of individuals that live in multiple family housing. And from staff in the town's perspective, we want to make sure that the service is available so that they can support recycling.
Is there an education component if the town council decides to go ahead and go forward with such a measure that the town would have the onus to provide?
Yes, I believe so. I think we would need to work with the Ecology Action Center, with private haulers, and with multiple family property management to make sure that people understand what should be recycled, what happens when things are contaminated, when individuals put their trash in the recycling cart, what happens. So I think education is going to be an important component of it. And I do believe that we've got great resources in the Ecology Action Center. They're going to be primed and ready to assist us with that.
That's going to be, at least in the students' case, an annual effort. Does the Ecology Action Center have the capacity to do that right now?
I think so. I think in partnership with the town and with stakeholder groups, the private haulers who also want this to be successful. They don't want to bring contaminated materials to the recycling site. So I think in partnership, we can be successful. In terms of the student changeover year after year, that's not unlike many other ordinances that we have in town, where it does take some education of students who might live off campus for the first time in terms of expectations or what's available to them in terms of town services. So we would incorporate that with many of our materials.
Pam Reese is the city manager of the town of Normal. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us on Sound Ideas the day after council meeting. This week included a fifth Monday during the month, so there was no council meeting. Next week, you'll hear from Town Mayor Chris Koos. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM, GLT, and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Kurtz Auto Body, serving McLean County and beyond for nearly 50 years. Auto body repair and painting covered by a limited lifetime warranty. Professional estimates with no appointment needed. Details at KurtzAutoBody.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, it's a conversation with State Senator Jason Barrickman about the upcoming legislative session. That's still to come during Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. Despite a massive rebuilding effort that included three waves of Ameren, Illinois workers, Puerto Rico is still experiencing setbacks to the restoration of electricity for homes and businesses. The devastation caused by Hurricane Maria last September destroyed the country's electrical grid. Last week, a subcontractor caused an island-wide blackout for up to 36 hours in some places. A week prior, that same subcontractor caused a temporary outage for nearly 900,000 residents when a tree fell on a power line. Before those setbacks, an estimated 97% of Puerto Rican homes and businesses had their power restored. Eric Estra of Lincoln worked as a supervisor of two four-man crews during the third wave of Ameren employees who helped to reconnect power on the island. He said Ameren prepared him and his crew well for the work, but he told GLT's John Norton he didn't expect Puerto Rico's mountains.
The funny thing is we landed, they took us on a charter bus to the hotel, and basically they dropped us off on the road and we had to walk up to the hotel probably, I don't know, say it was a couple hundred yards, but it was straight uphill and we're dragging our bags and everything up there with us. And I thought, what did I sign up for? Because it was, the train. I can't get over the train.
So are you doing pretty much the same thing the first two waves were doing, or are you following up on things?
As soon as we'd started sending up the side, we call it a hill, mountain, whatever you want to call it, but from sea level up to about 13 kilometers, and the first two bunches before us, they were putting up the main three-phase feeders, and then we were working on a lot of the taps, but it was unbelievable the amount the first two accomplished, and then the third wave also, but it was unbelievable and did it safely.
What was the devastation like by the time you got there?
It's still unbelievable. Supposedly, according to some of the locals, we were working kind of where the eye was. We were up by a rainforest, and it had been almost 7 months these people had been without power. And out of all our interactions, 99.9% of them were great. The locals were unbelievable. For being out 7 months, the vegetation had grown up because it's a tropical climate, so the vegetation, just unbelievable.
Getting to Puerto Rico, that was one of the big issues that the government was dealing with. It wasn't Texas or Florida where you could drive there. You had to get there by sea. What were the logistics like for Ameren to get there? How much went into that? How difficult was that?
The people behind the scenes setting all this up were amazing, as far as I'm concerned. The logistics to get barges, I think they're on a barge for 14 days to get to the island. Getting all of our equipment, material, supplies, everything down there was amazing. I mean, they had warned us worst case scenarios as far as, only drinking bottled water, and they had us prepared mentally and everything for worst case scenario. And when we got down there, Ameren did an unbelievable job as far as keeping us supplied with everything we needed.
Give me an example.
Tylenol, beef jerky, suntan lotion, just all the basic, the little necessities that we thought you're going to be going out without for 24 days. Pretty much anything you could think of, they either had or they could get it for us.
What did you bring with you?
My boss had laughed because I kind of went overboard. I actually brought a life straw with me, if you've ever heard of one, because I didn't know if we'd be drinking contaminated water. But I joked with my wife before I left. I thought I'd lose weight because the meals, they would bring us a lunch meal in a box, basically. You get a sandwich and a cookie or whatever. Just, it was okay, but I thought if we eat those for 24 days, it might be kind of rough. And out of the 24 days, I would say I had to eat one of those, maybe four. And other than that, the locals, who had nothing, cooked for us literally every day. And I actually came about 3 pounds heavier.
No kidding.
No kidding.
Talking with Eric Eskra, he's the supervisor of electric operations for Ameren, Illinois. This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Let me go back. When you got there, how much work was still left for you to do? Can you nail a percentage work that of businesses and homes that still needed to be hooked up when you got there?
I'm wanting to say when we left, the last number I saw is there's 95% was on. I believe when we got down there was in the 90s on, but what had happened is the farther we work up into the mountain, the conditions are, it's getting tougher and tougher to get that 5% back on. They're the ones that are off for a reason because the logistics, where they are at, is tough to get to.
And I would imagine some tough decisions need to be made on homes that might have been abandoned or just there's no way they're going to rebuild this thing. So when you say 95 to 98% are hooked up of the available houses, probably that are, is that an accurate way of saying that?
I would say so. We made decisions while we were down there. Like I said, it as our deployment started dwindling down, we had to make decisions on, who realistically we were going to be able to get back within power with power, and those that, like you said, the abandoned ones and the ones that had been vacated for several months, probably since the storm, we had to make decisions to just press on and get on the customers we could.
Let me ask you a broader question. How much devastation was there? How much needed to be, say, even built from the ground up, built from scratch, and how much could be salvaged?
I can just say by the amount of work I personally saw, the amount of poles that I saw from the main road, the Route 3, to up where we were working, not 100%, but it was devastated. I mean, it was a direct hit for I forget how many hours. The locals I talked to said the thing sat there and swirled over them. It was just unbelievable. I can't even describe the devastation, the amount of poles and wire and stuff that we saw new. It wiped it out for the most part.
Well, when you're up in the hills and you're doing the final hookups, what are some of the tough decisions you had to make when you're up there about who you hooked up and who you didn't hook up?
Okay, first of all, I'm here because I think it was a great experience. I want to tell my experience, but one of the things that bothered me more so than any storm I've ever worked on was knowing the fact that at some point we were leaving, and out of the 99.9% of good customers, that 0.1% that I had to deal with, unfortunately, we had a situation where our security was involved, the local police down there were involved, the power company, the PREPA, the Puerto Rican outfit was involved, and this customer refused to let us run wire through his over his property. And
which would connect to other people's property,
it would
right?
connect another probably half dozen to a dozen customers. And there was a gentleman, he was probably in his mid-60s. And the day we got there, we were expecting to get those people on. And then when we ran into that hiccup, we realized it wasn't going to happen. But the desperation, the communication was really hard because most of them didn't speak English and we didn't speak Spanish. But the look he had in his eyes, I've never seen in the guys who were with me. It was pure desperation. I don't even know how to explain it, but they'd been out for 7 months, and then we had to leave them because that one customer refused to let us help. But that look, I'll never forget, because I'm 40 years old, and I've never seen a look like that on a person's face.
Eric Eskras, who we're talking with, Supervisor of Electric Operations for Ameren, Illinois. I'm John Norton. This is GLT Sound Ideas. When we were talking off the air before we started the interview, you said that you made some really great connections with a lot of other people on the island as well. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. The people that we ran into up on the mountain, I don't know. I can't speak for the whole island, but the bunch we ran into, I had at least three separate households invite me and my family back there whenever we want to go to stay, not to stay in a hotel or anything. They welcomed us to stay at their house, and I truly believe I could call them in a year and go down there, and they would invite you in to stay. The people, for having nothing, they cooked for us almost every day. They were proud of what they had, even though most of them didn't have much. They took care of what they had, and great bunch of people.
How did it change you, just going down there for the time you were there?
For the most part, to think if we got it bad up here, to go without power for a day or two, or just little stuff in general. I mean, to have access to the grocery stores, and it is life-changing as far as I'm concerned. The little necessities, the little stuff in life, you know, that we give our kids, and these kids are out there playing with a rock and a stick, you know. It's a different world for sure.
I know there was a lot of frustration among the islanders initially that the federal government didn't react in a very timely manner. I would imagine you were seen in a much different light because you were actually there to help them and hook things up.
Yeah, I'd heard and had read the same thing, you know, and there was frustration, but
Was any of that shared with you, that they were frustrated with the initial response?
I think there's a little confusion, maybe. The people I ran into personally, though, all the locals that we interacted with, I think we honestly were the first people they'd seen in 7 months coming to help them. So we ran into no hostility at all. They were grateful, I think, for the sacrifices our Ameren employees had made to leave their families to come down there to help them. They were just grateful for somebody to be there helping them.
Ameren Supervisor Eric Eskra of Lincoln speaking with GLT's John Norton. Eskra returned to Illinois earlier this month after spending weeks in Puerto Rico reconnecting electricity to homes and businesses devastated by Hurricane Maria. Eskra was one of 225 Ameren workers who were part of a larger group of more than 3,000 power restoration workers coordinated by the Edison Electric Institute and Electric Industry Association. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. You can count State Senator Jason Barrickman as an optimist this year about the prospects for an on-time budget coming out of the General Assembly. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Barrickman about progress toward a budget in this election year.
It's a tough year here. We know, you know, this is going to be a record-setting election year, not in a good way. I think there's going to be hundreds of millions of dollars spent on the gubernatorial election alone. The result of that is there's a lot of noise, a lot of political noise that really gets in the way of doing our job. You know, I think the biggest priority of this spring is passing a balanced budget. We need that. I think there's a lot of pressure on both sides to get there for all the right reasons, right? I mean, I think a lot of people have learned of the importance of having a budget. Hopefully we've learned that that budget needs to be balanced. But there's this pressure that seems to be building on both sides to come together to a budget agreement. That gives me a little bit of optimism. The politics of the moment brings me back to reality. We had a meeting of the legislative leaders with the governor. Those, you know, sometimes those are productive, sometimes those aren't. The bottom line is they're necessary. People need to communicate with one another. And the way you communicate is you sit down and you be big boys and girls and you do it. So I was glad to see that that happened. The result of that meeting is that everyone said we're going to appoint certain legislators, budgeteers we call them, to really roll up their sleeves and work together and try to come to an agreement. Again, to me, that's good news.
There are varying estimates of how large the deficit is. There's one out there that's about $630 million, another that's $550 million. The governor recently said $3 billion, which is an outlier. What do you think the size of that gap is, and how do you think it should be addressed?
Here's what I think has happened. Last year, when the budget was finally adopted, and that was a very controversial issue, at that time, when you looked at the revenue estimates and the spend estimates from that budget, I probably told you and your listeners then exactly what I feel today, which is that budget was unbalanced roughly to the tune of $2 billion, you know, give or take. How's that?
Okay.
What I believe has happened since that budget was passed is that the administration has taken certain actions to rein in some of the spending that was appropriated. And that's an appropriate step, right? So the legislature says, here's the spend limit, that's the budget, and then the administration works within that budget and hopefully finds ways to spend less. I think that has actually happened. Again, this is good news. And so as a result, today, the budget gap for the current budget year is certainly less than the $2 billion. Is there a $600 million gap or a $500 million? I'm not sure. I think we can sort that out, and that will be sorted out through our budget process. All of these, though, are indicators that we, in the next fiscal year, ought to be able to come together because, you know, when you start talking about differences, our budget is roughly $40 billion. And when there's differences of opinion of, you know, hundreds of millions, not billions, to me, that's significant progress.
Do you think there remains a significant structural deficit?
Well, I think we have some issues here. We have, when you look at the big ticket items, things like our public pension system continues to show ballooning costs year after year. So if we do nothing, we know our pension costs this year are going to be greater than last year. Same goes for Medicaid. Medicaid has been very difficult for the state of Illinois to really wrap its hands around and limit the growth of it. And you can go on, right? I mean, I was an advocate for school funding reform, but the reality is that the needs in our public school system outweigh the dollars that are being sent to them today. You know, so when you say a structural deficit, there are existing demands for dollars that exceed the money coming in. Now, my, you know, the Jason Berrickman's proposal to that is we need to reprioritize how we spend, where we spend, and we need to rein in some of those costs. J.B. Pritzker has a very different solution. You know, J.B. Pritzker proposes that we should have not one but two tax increases on top of the one that just occurred last year.
Not only a interim tax increase, but then a graduated tax later on. Let's get to that second point. It is a political year. What do you think of a graduated tax?
I'm opposed to a graduated income tax, to be clear. I think that for all the negativity about the condition of our state and whether or not we're structured in a manner that can attract jobs, the jobs that we need, I think one of the benefits, one of the good things that Illinois has is a flat income tax. It was so important to have a flat income tax that the people who wrote our Illinois Constitution included a provision that says it has to be flat, that you can't play these games with a graduated income tax. I think that having a flat tax creates some predictability. It limits the gamesmanship that politicians and legislators do when there's a graduated income tax. And I think we ought to preserve it. I'm very concerned about Pritzker's plan to enact a graduated income tax. Many Republicans stood up and said, we're not in favor of that. We don't want to do that. And what was interesting was to hear the crickets that came out of the Democratic side of the aisle. I think there are some common sense Democrats who also recognize that this platform issue of Pritzker is not one that would be good for Illinoisans and that it won't be popular with Illinois voters. And so as much as Pritzker's going to pound his fists and say this is what we're going to do, I don't think it's going to be that easy. I think there's going to be a lot of resistance to it.
Polling shows it is a popular thing, though, and most neighboring states do have one.
Polling shows that tax increases are not popular. So, you know, I understand that the mantra of the National Democratic Party today is that we're going to tax the rich. But what you find when you look at states who have graduated income taxes is that it's not the rich who are the ones bearing the brunt of that tax increase. Many middle-class taxpayers are, in fact, seeing tax increases because of graduated income tax proposals. Whether they see it on day one or not depends on what's proposed, and we're waiting to see what Pritzker proposes. But even after day one, what happens is once those graduated rates are in place and people say, well, you know, here's where we're going to start for a family that makes $50,000 a year, what happens the next year and the year after that is they start to bring those income levels down. So they say, you know, this year, if you're a family that makes $50,000 a year, we're going to tax you at X. Next year, we're going to lower the threshold to those who make $40,000 or more, and we're going to tax them at that higher income tax rate. All that the graduated income tax proposal does is allows those who've been unable to control their spending to go find more people year after year and take more of their money out of their pocket and put it in the government's.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Jason Berrickman, state senator of Bloomington Normal, is our guest. For the last couple years, there has been a real problem with the governors engaging in the budget process. Now, last year, some Republicans departed from the governor and agreed to cross party lines, and a budget was passed. Is the governor's engagement more constructive this year than the hard line it was in the past?
Yeah, first of all, I think the governor was engaged in the budgeting process. I think what he failed to recognize was the pressure that Republican lawmakers felt from within their district to form a different opinion than he did on the budget. And ultimately what happened is in the series of negotiations, the governor formed more firm positions on spend levels and willingness to, you know, put forward tax increases. He took a more stringent position than certain Republican lawmakers did. And so they broke from him in that view, 15 of them, I think, ultimately. I think, you know, what I have counseled the governor and what I hope occurs from our side of the aisle is similar to what I hope to see out of the Democratic side of the aisle. I hope there's pressure put on the leaders. I hope there's pressure put on the governor that all sides be reasonable and come together to meet in the middle. Because ultimately, I think that's, again, we have a divided government. I think that is necessary here.
Is the governor showing signs that he is willing to meet in the middle this year, or will it be another case where House and Senate Republican lawmakers will have to do the deal themselves?
I think the fact that he called a legislative leaders meeting and the outcomes from that, those are good signs. I think those are appropriate steps from a governor to demonstrate leadership and a reasonableness to work together. You know, the Cullerton and Madigan didn't come out of that meeting and say, you know, that the governor put all these ridiculous demands out there. And that's because I don't think he did. Again, those are good signs. Really, you know, there's a lot of talk about the Republicans who broke ranks last year on the budget. But the other significant event of last year is when we came together to pass the historic school funding reform package. That was a highlight of our state's history, certainly a highlight of the Rauner administration. And though it was difficult to get both sides to come to an agreement, ultimately we did. And I really think that's the blueprint. You engage, you know, rank and file members to hash out as much of an agreement as you can. You have the leaders and the governor step in on the big issues that require their input. If they're reasonable to that, I think that's all a blueprint for how we get a budget done this year.
The governor didn't step in, though. It was largely House and Senate driven, and you were a significant driver of that. And the governor even vetoed one version.
But ultimately, the final product has components to it which are reflective of all the inputs that were there. You had Republicans from the House and the Senate who had their fingers all over this thing. You had Democrats from the House and Senate, same. And you had the governor. I mean, when we talk about the tax scholarship program that allows low-income students to have a choice in their education, especially if they live in a failing or a poorly performing school district, that tax scholarship program was certainly an issue that the governor put forward. So I think that, again, when everyone had an opportunity to have some input and make sure the final product reflected some of their opinions, I think that's how we get it done.
State Senator Jason Barrickman is a Republican from Bloomington. He spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Highway Chevrolet Buick GMC in El Paso, serving business owners and agricultural professionals across central Illinois, offering new and used cars and trucks and a certified GM service center. More information at highwaychevroletbuickgmc.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
As a new contributor, I'm asking you to become a first-time contributor. Hi, I'm Brian Johnson, and here's why I contribute. No other media source covers the local music scene in Bloomington Normal like WGLT. The Central Illinois Music Calendar tells me what bands are playing where. On Sound Ideas, musicians who will be playing locally are often interviewed. This introduces me to new music and helps me know if it's a band I want to see. Any of this sound like you? Join me in contributing during the GLT Fund Drive and help pay for everything GLT does with your first-time contribution. Click on donate at WGLT.org.
We're getting closer to meeting the fund drive goal every day, but can we keep it up and make the goal before the drive ends this week? That's a question only you can help answer. With your help, we bet we can. Remember, every contribution helps pay for the GLT programs you depend on. Don't wait. The drive ends soon. Contribute now at WGLT.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. At a time when lawmakers are talking about limiting program expansion at public universities to avoid duplication, Illinois State University is gathering information about starting an engineering program. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with ISU President Larry Dietz about the effort. He says he believes it would not be redundant because there are more engineering vacancies in the state than engineering graduates.
Our faculty have gone and visited some other institutions that have engineering programs similar to the kind of a footprint that we would like to have. And there are some preliminary recommendations that are out there, but the first thing is to determine what kind of engineering programs would be offering. We have, I think, narrowed the list down to probably mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, and possibly civil engineering. We offer a good number of courses in engineering physics and engineering systems that could fit into those. We have, obviously, two major companies that are either just recently in town or coming to town, and the Rivian Automotive with electric cars, and so we think maybe electrical engineering might fit there well. Brandt is coming in, and they may have a need for electrical and mechanical engineering. So we're having preliminary conversations with lots of different folks, but the main group are our faculty who are doing the investigating, and that's the way it should be on this. So I'm optimistic that we'll be able to do something, but if it, you know, if the faculty if they don't think it'll work for us, and it won't work. But the preliminary conversations are very optimistic, and I think it would help us change the curriculum a little bit and meet a huge demand, because there's not enough engineers being produced in the existing engineering programs across the state.
Timeline to generate a recommendation and then to seek IBHE approval if the recommendation goes that way?
I expect to receive some formal recommendations sometime this summer. You know, based upon what those are, I'm not sure we're going to be ready to go to IBHE by the fall, but I haven't received any concrete recommendations yet, but the task force is supposedly going to get me something sometime this summer.
The university has also been focusing more on trying to attract international students. How goes that effort, and what's the assessment of the potential marketplace for ISU?
Well, I think we're going along very, very well. We're certainly within our timeline of the planning on all of this. We had a group of about 80 individuals from 40 countries throughout the world. They spent basically an entire week here. It's called a familiarization trip, you know, looking at our academic programs, our services that we offer, getting to know some of our faculty and staff. And they are starting recruiting now for this fall, which is a little late, but by the same token, we really had not planned on admitting a lot of students for this fall. We will some, and that'll help test out our programs and our systems with all of that. I expect that, you know, the larger amount will be a year from this fall. The individuals who were here were very, very complimentary. And I think the newspaper called this a hidden gem, was their description of that. And again, we're not trying to increase our numbers dramatically. We only have about 2% of nearly 21,000 students from other countries now. Most of the institutions in the country that are our size have between 10 and 15%. So our initial goal is to get to 10% over many, many years. So we're going to do this in the way that university is known to do things, and that is carefully, conservatively, but successfully, and I'm very encouraged.
How is international recruiting best done? This word-of-mouth recommendation pipeline that you're trying to create by showing off the institution to educational interest in other countries, or is it a direct marketing kind of thing that ISU will have to do as well?
That's the beauty part of entering into an agreement with this N2ISU. It's a public-private partnership, and it really is a partnership. Their expertise is in the marketing and recruiting part of all that. So we have done that consciously, so we're not spending the money on all of that. They are. And so they work with the top of the enrollment funnel, if you will. That's the most expensive part of the funnel, and that's why they have representatives from throughout the world who physically are located in those areas. So they will do all of that heavy lifting for us, but we determine the academic criteria, we determine the number, we determine the countries that they'll be coming from, and the fields that they'll be going into. So university controls all of that, which is the lower end of that funnel, more narrow part of that funnel. That part is really going along very, very well. And every place that they've had an installation, they only have 12 of them in the United States, but every place that they've been successful. And it's institutions like Colorado State, Oregon State, George Mason, University of South Florida, other really premier institutions in those states. And we're the only institution in the state of Illinois they want to do business with. And they're the only pathway program that we want to do business with. So I think it's a recipe for success.
What are the economics of it? How do they make their nut, as it were?
Sure. Well, they've been at it for quite a while. And we're not doing this for the numbers. We're doing it to increase our diversity and enrich in the learning environment for our students. There is a financial payoff. I'm not going to dodge that at all. The amount of money that will come in from non-resident students basically is twice the amount that we get from resident students, and they tend to go into fields that some of our domestic students are not going into. I would be remiss also if I didn't say, though, that we made a commitment and that we're not going to displace Illinois taxpaying students with students from other countries. Any Illinois student who meets our admission criteria will get into the program that they want to get into. And so this, in my estimation, really rounds out the overall student population, and they bring a dimension that other people can't bring, and that is their culture, their different ways of doing a business, doing work, and we're going to learn as much from people from other countries as they will learn from us.
And how much of the increased revenue from those international students do you have to share with the pipeline organization that you're using?
Yeah, there's a formula that's pretty complex. It's been developed, but we will certainly cover our costs, and they will cover their costs with all of this. But there's more factors than that than I want to get into today.
ISU President Larry Dietz, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Charlie.
Illinois State University will graduate, or rather will award, more than 3,700 baccalaureate degrees and more than 600 graduate degrees May 11th and 12th. ISU President Larry Dietz talked with GLT's Charlie Schlinker. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Charlie Schlinker and Ryan Denham. Find the full show podcast at NPR One or WGLT.org. We want to know what you think. Post your comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. This is WGLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.